On this week's 51%, it's exam time for many, and new research suggests that women have more test anxiety than men.
Women often are hemorrhaging out of these large intro classes, and that could be in part because they underperform on these exams.
We hear about a new contraceptive law in Massachusetts and have a different look at the Me Too social media campaign. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Research has long shown that women who enter college intending to pursue a career in science, technology, engineering, or math abandon that path more frequently than their male peers. And now a new study out of Stanford University and the University of Minnesota has found a possible source of that gender gap. High-stakes exams at the college level can actually put female students at a disadvantage. The study's findings suggest that women are more heavily influenced than men by test anxiety, and are more often weeded out in large gateway classes early on in their education. 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall spoke with one of the study's co-authors, University of Minnesota postdoctoral associate Sissy Ballin, about the study and about how reducing test anxiety could help close a pervasive gender gap in STEM.
The study, it all kind of came about when we were looking at these 10 large introductory biology courses. And I'm an education researcher, and I was really interested in different predictors of exam performance in particular with these students. And when we isolated just exam scores, we found that there was a significant difference between how men and women performed on these exams. And so, the next logical step was to look at what actually influences performance on these exams for men and women. That's when we got Stanford involved and analyzed other predictors of exam performance for men and women, and we found that for women only, test anxiety had a strong impact of how they did on exams, and that was regardless of their previous preparation for that exam. And so definitely these results definitely have strong implications in how we should assess students.
Did you delve into why you thought maybe women had greater test anxiety?
You know, I think there are a lot of reasons why women might have higher test anxiety. There's a lot of literature that suggests that women are judged more harshly when they do things poorly. There's also a large literature that looks to stereotype threat, which is this idea that through people fearing that they may conform or be judged for some stereotype, they actually conform to that stereotype. So in that case, it would be intellectual ability or capacity in women. And that's been demonstrated in other minority groups.
Now, do you think that this higher level of test anxiety is partly to blame for maybe a gender gap in STEM fields?
Oh, totally. So, I mean, there's this attrition in the STEM pathway or pipeline that people often talk about when they talk about gender gaps in just retention of women in STEM. And I think this is a big contributing factor because, I mean, when it comes down to it, these kind of big gateway, they're often called weed-out courses, that is one of these leaky places along this pipeline. And so women often are hemorrhaging out of these large intro classes. And that could be in part because they underperform on these exams. And so, yeah, I definitely think that's a contributing factor. And when it comes down to it, really, the first step of keeping women is in science is keeping them in their first-year science course.
Which biology is kind of the hallmark of that, right?
Exactly, yeah. So these are all in introductory biology courses.
Was there a particular reason that you chose the biology courses as opposed to something like chemistry or physics or computer science or English? I don't know what fields you had to choose from, but why biology?
Well, I think there are a few answers to that. One is that I am an evolutionary biologist by training, and so it was in part a matter of access. You know, I have access to biology courses. But also, biology is a kind of a funny STEM field because it is dominated by women. And so there's an overrepresentation of women in biology. And of course, that changes as students go through this pipeline. And so by the time you look at the faculty level, women are a minority in biology. But it's an interesting course to study in STEM because I think, if anything, it's giving you some conservative estimate of the chilly climate that women may be experiencing in STEM classes.
Can you talk more about how you think we could counteract, I should say, the effects of this test anxiety?
I think there are a lot of things that we're doing now and that we're testing in the classroom to address just this. You know, it could be that we lower the sense of risk in exam environments just by, for instance, lowering the percentage that exams account for in the student's total course grade. You could provide retakes. You could provide less exams or no exams. I think that overall, the bigger concern is that I'm not convinced at all that exams are an adequate measure of actual content knowledge. And so I think that, you know, if we're trying to develop these young scientists, we should reward things like their ability both to know the material, but also to engage in cooperative group work and to work hard and to put in time and to answer things accurately. There's just nothing that, you know, students' ability to operate in like this high-pressure cooker exam environment that doesn't breed the types of qualities that we want to in our developing scientists of the next generation.
What would you define as high-stakes testing?
It's the midterms, the final exams. I mean, SATs and ACTs and GREs, I'd say those are all high-stake exam environments.
The concept of the low-stakes testing, the other kind of side of the spectrum that you were talking about, does that include things like laboratory assignments and things like that within the field
Absolutely.
Of biology?
Yeah, exactly. So laboratory assignments, in-class quizzes. We have these little iClickers, which are these personal response systems, so you can get responses from students in real time.
Oh, wow.
And often they're able to, you know, talk to their groups before they respond. And, yeah, all sorts of things, cooperative group work, presentations, you know, projects and papers, and all of those are considered low stakes.
What other studies can be done? I mean, what's the next kind of study after this one?
You know, right now we are working on a lot of different projects that address just this, like how does our assessment actually influence student performance? And so we're doing things ranging from empirical research that allows students to have retake exams and looking at the effect that lowering the sense of risk in the classroom through retake exams might influence a gender bias in performance. We're also looking at just lowering the risk through lowering the proportion that these exams account for in students' total course grade. We're looking at different disciplines, and so right now we just tested this in biology, but how does this impact students in physics and chemistry and engineering and math? And so we're addressing this from a number of different angles. What I'm most excited about is we're doing some work that I can't talk too much about, but it's linking some physiological measures to student self-reported anxiety levels. And so we can look at whether student self-reports are actually a real measure of what they're actually experiencing.
Where do you see female participation in STEM careers going, I guess, based on what you've seen in these studies?
Most instructors teaching these large introductory classes, you know, I assume that they want to do the best for their students, that they see the classroom environment as somewhere that they can nurture student learning and provide the best learning experiences for their students. But I also think that there is a subset of instructors that really see these large gateway courses as kind of weed-out courses. I think this is how they've been sort of historically treated, and I think that's something that needs to be addressed if we hope to promote more diversity in science by any definition. And so I think that we should be focused more on how the teaching can serve the students rather than how we can change the students to, you know, do better in these courses that are not cut out for certain students.
That was University of Minnesota postdoctoral associate Sissy Ballin speaking with 51%'s Jessica Blaustein Marshall. Republican Governor Charlie Baker signed a bill in November ensuring no-cost contraceptives in Massachusetts, regardless of health care law on the federal level. 51%'s J.D. Allen spoke with State Representative Tricia Farley Bouvier, a Pittsfield Democrat, about the law.
It's important that we as leaders in Massachusetts protect the citizens of Massachusetts against adverse policy that's coming out of Washington, D.C. And the access bill is just one of the ways that we can do that. So this bill mandates coverage for contraception. We cover, you know, have no copay for contraception. We allow for up to a year's supply, which research has shown reduces pregnancy because it enhances people taking it on a regular basis, having to go back every month to renew your prescription or refill your prescription can be a barrier for some people when it comes to contraception. It also pays for the morning after pill, which is not covered in the ACA. So Massachusetts, once again, has shown their leadership when it comes to health care and protecting the rights of women. And I think this is just one of the things that we need to do to protect the citizens of Massachusetts.
So the law was shepherded through by Senate Majority Leader Harriet Chandler of Worcester and House Speaker Pro Tem Patricia Haddad of Somerset. The law, as you said, requires pharmacies to stock the morning after pill and offer it for free without a prescription. But in your district, mainly Pittsfield, teen birth rates are some of the highest in the state. Why is that?
So we've talked about teen birth rates for many years in Pittsfield. And there has been a coalition gathered around this issue for 6, 7, 8 years now that has shown itself to be extremely effective. And we have reduced teen birth rates by 50% in that time. And this is, again, another tool that we are going to be able to use to continue to reduce that rate. Access to contraception, access to really good sex education are the tools that we are using to be able to reduce that teen birth rate. And giving young women a future that they can look at, that they can aspire to, aspirations, and having an ability to look at their future to see possibilities is a major contributing factor to reducing the teen birth rate.
Is there any educational component to the new law that could help these young women?
So not this particular law, that's not included. I will say that the school districts in Berkshire County are doing a great job individually in adding excellent education when it comes to sex ed. But there is a law, a companion law, to this, to this called the Healthy Youth Law, which mandates that any school system that provides sex ed has to do it in a way that uses best practices, and, you know, there's a standard by which they have to follow. And that law, that bill has been in the legislature for a couple of sessions now, and we continue to work to pass that.
It sounds like Massachusetts is getting closer to a universal health care kind of idea. Is this what the state needs?
I really support efforts to take a really good look at costs. And what the cost would be compared to have, universal health care or a single payer. So we have to remember that Massachusetts has always been a leader when it comes to health care. And we have had, more than 97% of our population covered in Massachusetts. And we certainly have led the nation for a long time when it comes to health care coverage.
That was State Representative Tricia Farley Bouvier, a Democrat from Pittsfield, Massachusetts, speaking with 51%'s J.D. Allen. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, opioids, including prescription painkillers, heroin, and fentanyl, killed more than 33,000 people in 2015, more than any year on record. We go to a suburb of Seattle to hear from Radioactive reporter Brian Freeland and a story of a female teen's struggle with addiction.
I went to Kentwood High School in Covington, Washington. This is where I first met Alyssa Gardinier. I was a naive freshman, she was a cool junior, a child of theater, smiling, cheerful, and happy. Or so I thought. Little did I know of the dark secret that possessed her ever since childhood. When she was 10 years old, she found the spot where her parents hid the alcohol. The moment it first touched her lips, she was addicted to that escape. In middle school, smoking weed took away her social anxiety and allowed her to be the person she'd always wanted to be. It escalated from weed to other popular drugs such as Molly, ecstasy, and meth, but nothing could give her the escape she craved. So she turned to heroin when she was 14.
What people don't tell you about heroin, they tell you all the scary stuff, but the scariest thing that they don't tell you is that you are gonna love it. Like, you're gonna love it so much, and it will trick you because you just think, oh, this is nice. It's not that big of a deal.
Heroin, like the weed in middle school, made her more comfortable. She could finally talk to people, something she'd been struggling with for a while. She was happier, more liked, both by herself and others.
I thought it was a blessing because I could focus in school.
Eventually, she went back for more, doing anything she could to pay for that escape. She used her own money for heroin. Her reasoning was that it was hers to do what she wished with. Then, she started selling her parents' things, stealing, and even begging on the streets.
I did some pretty bad things. You know, things that I would have never imagined myself doing, but it just escalates and escalates. And that desperation and the way that the drugs make you feel, it doesn't even matter at that moment what you do. You just have to get money anyhow, any way to get your dope. That's what you have to do in your head.
She was unpredictable, a wild card.
My own family didn't even know who I was anymore. I didn't even know who I was anymore.
Her mom discovered some dirty needles and confronted her. At first, Alyssa was tempted to lie, but decided to finally come clean.
I got honest for the first time, probably ever, about this. And I went to her and we cried together. We talked about what we were going to do. We discussed treatment. And that's the first time we really, like, came together and tried to come up with a plan.
As much as it frightened her mother, it might have had the biggest impact on her dad.
He was pretty devastated. He had been an alcoholic pretty much my whole life. And so there was a lot of guilt there, and he thought that maybe it was his fault. Me watching him could have led to me using. It wasn't until I went to treatment and we all met with a counselor that I realized really how much it was affecting him in every aspect of his life.
Her journey began with a 134-mile drive to a treatment center in Yakima.
And I had no intentions of staying here, but as time went on, I realized that I really did want to stay sober this time.
But her journey was long from over.
I got a little bit cocky and I thought that I did have it on my own. I made it to about 9 months of sobriety and I had a job. I had a house to live in. I had real friends. I had built my life up and I had a lot to lose.
And then Alyssa relapsed.
And that's just the way addiction works. You fool yourself into thinking that something will never ever happen again, or it won't be me, or I won't do this. And that's just justifying your use, and you'll be exactly back where you were, or you'll be sleeping on a church bench, not knowing where to go or what to do.
Alyssa decided to try again. Today, Alyssa is 20 years old and living 11 months clean in Yakima, working as a daycare teacher and living every day to the fullest.
I don't feel this constant pressure to have to go out and do something or be somebody that I'm not, or I can just focus on being me.
Through the many struggles life's thrown at her, as well as this major roadblock, she made it and has come through a better person. From Radioactive, this is Brian Freeland.
Brian Freeland produced this story through KUOW's Radioactive Youth Media in Seattle. You can learn more at kuow.org/radioactive. Actress Alyssa Milano took to Twitter October 15th, sparking tens of thousands of responses to her Me Too campaign. It took off on other social media platforms, and it started with sexual assault accusations against Hollywood movie producer Harvey Weinstein. Since, such accusations have spread from Hollywood to the political realm. The idea behind Me Too is to encourage sexual assault survivors and sexual harassment victims to post the hashtag to raise awareness. And it's not just happening in the U.S. As KALW's Sandy Broy reports, the Me Too hashtag carries more weight than your average social media meme in India.
I must confess, when the Me Too hashtag started flooding my social media timeline, I was skeptical. I am a social media cynic, even as I'm a social media addict. I think of it as a performance space, faux activism, a blip of feel-good catharsis. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata. But there was something different about Me Too. I was not surprised that it was so pervasive, so ubiquitous, that it touched almost every woman on my timeline. As a beloved friend in her 70s said, you cannot be alive this long and not say Me Too. But then another professional acquaintance, a man, wrote, when your daughter also posts Me Too. This hashtag can cut too close to the bone. That's when it became discomforting. The woman across the office with whom you laugh, joke, argue every day still laughs, jokes, and argues and meets her deadlines. But you realize that in between all that, she also posted Me Too. She does not talk about it, neither do you, but you know. She knows you probably know. That knowledge has weight. This hashtag carries weight. Other hashtags have been different, when they support gay rights or when they say Je suis Charlie Hebdo. They are about solidarity, not vulnerability. They allow us to wear our liberal credentials on our sleeves with the click of a Facebook filter. This one turns the lens around from others to ourselves. This is the first hashtag that made me look at those I know differently. And this is also the first hashtag that made me look at myself differently as well. This is a difficult conversation disguised as a hashtag. Now, the conversation just got more difficult in India thanks to someone in California. Raya Sarkar, a law student in Davis, decided to create a list, a crowdsourced list of Indian academics who have been accused of sexually harassing their students. It created a stir as over 60 names showed up from premier Indian institutions. Sarkar says it's for students to be wary of professors through first-hand accounts of victims. Now, it's all over the news.
From the Me Too movement to now naming and shaming those who indulge in sexual harassment online. And remember, this in educational institutions is something, of course, that is now trending online. This list is growing by the hour.
But while Me Too created an outpouring of solidarity, this naming and shaming has split even the feminist groups. One group signed an open letter saying it is worrying that anyone can be named anonymously with lack of answerability and that those guilty of sexual harassment are placed on par with unsubstantiated accusations. As Ashwini Deshpande, professor at Delhi University, tells NewsX.
The question is whether making such lists which flatten the problem, which provide no context, and which are amenable to being used to settle personal animosities, is that really a good way of going about highlighting the issue?
Another activist, Kavita Krishnan, wrote that while men on the list might well be guilty, an anonymous list is akin to blackening faces, publicly parading and socially boycotting people based on anonymous allegations. But lawyer Karuna Nandi tells NDTV that in her mind, the list is really an act of civil disobedience.
And the fact that women from, you know, Delhi and Cochin and Kolkata are trusting somebody they never met over the internet, and they are writing to her and trusting her.
Yes.
And trusting her to be the gatekeeper of truth, right? Exactly. Which is something that is troubling in a larger sense, obviously. But I don't think it's anyone's case that due process should be binned. I don't think it's anyone's case that this is a trope that should continue and should happen all the time. I think this is more a disruption of the system.
Okay.
The list might be problematic, but the bigger problem is so many women feel that it's necessary, that they didn't even feel that they could file a complaint, that the old boys club was just too loaded against them. As a man, I can take refuge in the bubble of not me. I am not the gang rapist. I'm not the one who shoved my hand down a woman's shirt. I'm not Harvey Weinstein. But the list is a reminder that sometimes that's not enough. It erodes the comfort of not all men. If nothing else, this hashtag and the list in its wake has made us realize that even being a bystander to harassment does not let any of us off the hook. This is Sandeep Roy in Kolkata.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org and follow us on Twitter at 51% Radio. This week's show is number 1481.